So I assume that you got a chance to watch that hour-long movie about the discovery of another, a new molecule of carbon. I loved it when I first saw it, and I have been showing it to people for the last, I guess, 20 years or so, because it shows many elements of how science works in practice. So this is going to be really a very short presentation. Normally, when I have a lot of time, we watch the movie together. I always enjoyed watching it again. But now we don't have a lot of time. We just have 20 hours of meetings, 10 meetings. So we have to make it shorter. When I finish with this, we will start another topic, which is identifying research problems. I think it's a very useful skill, one of the most important ones. So, motivating example, you've seen it. Here it is. Here's where we are. The link worked still. I hope you get a chance to watch it. I send you this list to look at, to pay attention to some of the things. There are really several elements of what I'm covering in this seminar right there in the movie. You saw it in action. Buckminster Fullerenes. Let's go. So some of the, I'm just going to share with you some of my observations. How did the scientists in the movie got into their research area? I guess picking hard problems, but ones that people did not care about or did not identify on time. You notice several people who were scooped up, they say it in English. So they had the idea, they observed a peak in the spectrum, but they thought, well, it's junk, right? It's nothing special. It was, I guess, too difficult, or they just didn't notice what was really important there. They had unusual experiences. I'm going to talk more about this. For example, Croto, the British guy with the British accent, he wanted to study architecture. And he knew, because of that, the work of Buckminster Fuller, an American architect, quite unconventional, doing very special types of structures. You've seen probably enthusiasm of people, the importance of thinking, where the critical things happened when they were thinking very hard. And there were a lot of coincidences and also persistence. Things didn't work out, they try again, they tried different things, they were persistent. Funding, that's one of the mechanisms in science. Where do you get the money from? The world is not a very just and equitable place. You have probably figured that out already. And some places have more resources than others. For example, smallest lab in Texas, where everything is big, everything... That's actually what Americans are saying themselves. Everything is big in Texas. Smalley said that in the movie. There's a joke about that. I think it's a Polish joke about Texas. I don't know if you've heard it. A blind person goes to Texas. In the plane, he finds his seat. He sits down and he wonders, wow, it's so big here. So he says to a stewardess, hey, you have very big seats in this plane. And the stewardess says, this is Air Texas, and everything is big in Texas. So he goes to Texas, lands in Austin, let's say, and before going to bed, he goes and thinks, well, let me have a glass of beer. He goes to a bar and asks for a glass of beer, and they give him something that he feels is like a bucket. So he says, well, you have very big glasses here in this bar. This bar is in Texas. Everything is big in Texas. So he starts drinking, and halfway, he really feels the urge to go to the toilet, as you know, after having beer. He asks, could you please tell me where the restroom is? And the guy says, oh, that's easy. Take that door in the corner, turn left, then the second right, left and right again, and you will find the door on the right-hand side is gentleman's restroom. Of course, after the half the bucket of beer, he mixed up the directions. and he ended up in a swimming pool. He stumbled and fell into the water and started screaming, "Please don't flush, please don't flush." Well, that's a Polish joke about Texas. So some places have resources, and science, if you look at it, it's not an accident, not a coincidence that a lot of, for example, theoretical physics work is done in Switzerland, where they have a big accelerator, or in, Caltech has also an accelerator, but this is the university with the highest number of Nobel Prize winners. They have the resources, they have the culture, and you've seen that here also. Smalley wanted to go to Texas because they had the resources. They had big labs with a lot of equipment. Once you can show something, it's easier to get money. In the beginning, Croto was pulling money out of his wife's account, if you remember, to fly to Texas. Yes. Later, probably the funding agencies were knocking on his door and asking, would you please take a grant from us? Why did they do that? Well, because they wanted to be reported in the acknowledgments of his papers, and they smelled this is a great discovery that may lead to something big, and it led. They got Nobel Prize for that work. So it's easier when you can show something to get money. Sometimes personal funds, you've seen, said that. Vacuum cleaners. He brought a vacuum cleaner from home. I've done things like that too, you know, sometimes. Publishing is also a game. You notice that, the title of the original production was called Race to Catch a Buckyball. Race, a competition. Who is going to be the first? At some point, paper after paper were produced. Somebody said that, I think maybe the narrator or somebody in the movie. In the beginning, if you remember, Huffman and Kretschmer were talking about their work in Germany, in the Black Forest, where they observed something. One of them, I think it was the Kretschmer, thought it was junk. Huffman thought there was something in it, but they ended up not publishing anything. They decided not to publish. And then Croto and Smalley created a competition. If you remember in the movie, they showed everybody is publishing, everybody is investigating that because it's important. There was a paper published in Capri in a conference, remember that was also, there's always a decision. And is it a good moment to publish or should I wait a little bit more? If you wait more, you will work out the idea better, and you get more effect from your publication. If you publish early, then nobody can scoop you up, because you publish it, nobody can say it's their work. It's not who invented something first, but who published it first. Right? So it's a game, really. Last question is, they work together, Smalley and Croto. Smalley have gone on his own and published without Croto? It's an interesting idea that has really great big implications, ethical implications. He could do it, but it would be not very moral, not very ethical to do it, because they work together, they discuss things. A lot of ideas came from one or the other. It was just a discussion. It's similar, in my view, to a couple, married couple, divorcing, and then having children. There is a tendency among couples whose relationships have gone wrong to look at the children and say, this child is, say, as lazy as his father. Right? Kind of blame the father for bad things, the spouse for the bad things, and then praising for good things. It's a tendency, but the child is really a product of both parents. Any way you look at it, it's both parents that produce the child. The same here. Any intellectual contribution comes from two people. So, the practical implication is if you work with your advisor, with your mentor, you cannot just go out and publish things on your own, things that you discussed with your advisor. Because there were maybe subtle contributions that the advisor made in the interactions. Remember that. And also remember, if you want to avoid putting something on a somebody on a paper as a co-author, well, don't work with them. That's the safest way of not having them as potential co-authors. So we will talk more about this maybe a little bit towards the end of the course about the ethics of science. But it's actually quite common sense, but sometimes people don't fully live up to it or fully understand. There are no real boundaries. The world is small. I mentioned to you last week that I'm going to talk about whatever I have learned, and I have learned in US environment, in American environment, but science is very, very global. Science is done in a similar way everywhere in the world, including right here in Białystok. The world is small. If you saw, there were people in US working, people who were born in places all over the world, right? There was not just British in England, Americans in US. There was a British guy flying to Texas to work with people. There were scientists who got their PhDs in US or elsewhere working for companies like Exxon. Networking, again, I mentioned that last week. Please note how Croto, I think, well, how Croto got to Texas. I think he got to know that Smalley in Texas, maybe at some conference, and well, he had some place in Texas where he could go to. Hoffman went to Black Forest in Germany. Again, how did he get to know the other guy? Well, probably a conference, probably queuing up for coffee or having lunch together, and then sending an email, I'm up for a sabbatical, I'm looking for a good place to do interesting research. Would you accept me? It's much easier to do it this way than to write a letter to somebody who doesn't know you. People usually ignore letters like this because there are many, many letters like this coming. Croto gets a copy of a paper from a friend who attended a workshop in Capri, remember? If he didn't know Croto, he would never have thought about sending him a paper. He knew Croto and he knew what Croto was doing. Why? Because probably they talked at a conference somewhere, at a meeting. A structure of labs. There's a professor, the big guy. There are postdocs, research assistants, and somebody has to do the dirty work. They show it very nicely in the movie. This graduate student walking back and forth with vacuum cleaners, right, setting up things. You could think it's exploitation of doctoral students. That's one way of looking at it. But actually, it's a symbiosis. You learn as an apprentice from the master, and it's a symbiosis because you learn from the master. The master has somebody to set up the vacuum cleaners, right? So it's nothing unusual. Of course, there may be some places where this is driven too far, right? Can happen. But normally it's a symbiosis. I don't think it was driven too far in what you saw in the movie. Look at scientists in US. Quite likely, majority is foreign-born. It's they are draining the brains of other nations, attracting them. Again, it's a symbiosis. This is a very good place to do work, to do research. That's why people are going there, to do their doctoral studies and to work. But science is global. Typical working places. We don't see that in Europe a lot, a little bit. In Europe, typically, people get a doctorate and go to work in universities. But if what you saw in US is more of a global market. You saw industrial research labs like Exxon. That's one way. In fact, probably majority of people in US go to industrial research labs. There are not so many in Poland yet, although we have Google, I think, in Kraków. I'm sure Google attracts many PhDs to its lab, and some other companies, but that's one of the places. Startup companies, we didn't see that in the movie, but sometimes people with a doctorate have a good idea. The idea belongs to them. They developed it in the course of their studies. They may patent it, create a company, and live that way. And there are many other places you can become a technical writer, a journalist, you can become a politician. We've seen that in Poland. I mentioned Pawlak, and there are several people with doctorates among the in the parliament or in the European Parliament. Social character of science. I hope you have seen that in the movie, that there was no central authority telling whether they are doing good work or not. It was just people judging each other. Sometimes you may have to do something really very, very big and get the reward for that only after you die. That happens also. Not very fair, not very just, but it could happen. Other people judge whether your work is good. Remember, they were sending things to Croto at some point because he was the highest, he was the most well-known as the person who actually discovered those buckyballs. Hoffman, I think, said, "Well, too busy for me. I'm withdrawing from that. I like to be a lone ranger. I don't want to be in so much competition." Doctorate is also judged by your peers. These are going to be, first of all, your advisor. Don't even think of trying to defend your dissertation without your advisor being on your side. Listen to the advisor. If the advisor says, "Well, it's good enough," go ahead. If the advisor says, "No, I don't think it's good enough," you don't have a lot of choice, I think. You still can push for a defense, but I would advise to listen to the advisor. And then you have reviewers, probably two reviewers from outside of the university who are going to read your dissertation and decide, write a review and decide if it's good enough or not. The same with every paper. Science is not free of bad people. Like in every social activity of humans, it's not that, you know, very clean area where only good people are working. Maybe you have already seen, maybe you will see people who have bad intentions, who are abusing their doctoral students, their colleagues, or other people. They are falsifying data and publishing junk. So there are people like this, but I dare to say that there are fewer of them in science than in other enterprises. I guess because the rewards of being a scoundrel are not very high. Well, you publish one more paper, two more papers, five more papers. But when they discover that you've done something unethical, very often that's the end of you. So I absolutely advise you against doing anything kind of, you know, not completely ethical or legal. Don't do that. The rewards are low and the penalties are high in terms of the social ostracism that you will encounter. A lot of synonyms of scoundrel in Polish aren't there. Publications. Worth mentioning that definitely the basic mechanism for communicating results. Oral presentations. You have to learn how to present. The reason for that is that it's a very inexpensive way of marketing. Just yesterday, I had a presentation in the Statistical Society, it's part of the government, the Statistical Office of Poland, collaborating with a department in the University in Białystok. And just today, I got a phone call. Somebody heard the talk and said, "Would you please talk in our workshop that is happening Saturday next week?" What was my answer?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, I'll be delighted to. In both cases, of course. And your answer should be also like this. Every opportunity that you get to talk, absolutely, I'll be delighted to. Don't think about the amount of work that you have to put into it, because that's actually very little work. I can reuse the slides. I was reusing some of my slides for the first presentation. Next presentation, the same slides even. Very inexpensive, and the effect is... you have, 20, 30 people in the audience who are devoting their time to being here, so they are also listening to you. You can convince them about your work. You can tell them about your work. So very inexpensive and also not completely ineffective, because the number of people who will read the publication is not necessarily bigger than 20 and 30. Then, but it's also the least valuable. The only thing you can do with it is maybe put it in your vita that you present it here and there. Technical reports, web pages, nobody reviews them. It's you who decides to put it there. Not very valuable in terms of points. In fact, the Ministry of Science and Education in Poland gives no points for that, right? You know it. Then books. There are fundamental books that are really opening up an area, but textbooks that you write for people to read, to teach, they are not really, they don't give you a lot of points, typically. They cost a lot of time and don't give you a lot of points. I was given the advice by my colleagues, don't even bother about this. I've never written a book. It's just not giving you a lot of credit, although there are fundamental books, I have to say. So if you have really something interesting to say, it may be worth it. But just a book, it's not worth a lot. There are reviews, but usually after publishing. Well, sometimes publisher sends the proposal for a book to several scientists and asks, what do you think about this? I've gotten requests to give my opinion about a book based on one or two pages written by the author. But usually there are stupid reviews in journals. I'm putting it in quotes because I'm, of course, joking. And there are no stupid reviews really well. Maybe there are, but I haven't seen many of them. It's just your first reaction when you read a critical review, then, oh, boy, this is stupid. Then there are workshops, symposia, annual meetings, where you write a paper for. There is some review, but not a lot. It's very fast. It's again, it's not worth a lot like as a publication. I don't think it's even on the list of the ministry. You don't get any points for that. But it's nice because you can put it in your vita, your publications. Then there are peer-reviewed conferences, depending on the field. Some conferences are very, very valuable, very reputable. It's sometimes more difficult to get a paper in that conference than it is in a journal. And every field has such conferences. You should ask your advisor which conferences are there in your field. Reviews are frustrating because they're usually good in terms of very thorough. The reviewers read your paper carefully and write feedback, but there is no time to discuss, to argue with them, because there's a quick timeline. Submission deadline, March 15. Reviews and acceptance decisions, April 15, conference, May 15 or June 15, whatever. I'm just giving example dates. No time for any discussion. So if you get a stupid review, sorry, you have to wait for another year if you want to publish in the same conference. And then there are journals. In some fields, journals are the main publication. Today, the Ministry of Science in Poland gives points for conferences, but very good conferences, the prime conferences, and journals. And they give different amount of number of points depending on the quality of the journal. What is the quality of the journal? Well, they measure it over time in terms of how many people quote, cite papers from the journal, the impact the papers have. It usually, you cannot tell in advance with a new journal where it's going to land, but over time, the journal will definitely develop a reputation and that will be reflected in the points. Or something more objective, I think, is the impact factor. It's an international thing. There's a formula how it's calculated. It depends on the citations and other things. Impact factor is more trustworthy than some list from some ministry. In any case, remember, this is the prestige, the importance. You should do all of that, but you cannot just do technical reports, web pages, and workshops and symposia. You are going to be, when somebody looks at your vita, says, well, can this person write a real publication or not? And the real publications are the prime conferences and journals. That's where you should aim. But it's okay to attend workshops, symposia in your field. Sometimes a lot of interesting things are happening in those workshops and symposia. grants, it's money that they give you. They are giving you now money, your stipend, right? That's a way of saying, we liked your application, we liked your achievements so far and what you are going to do. We are giving you money for the next 4 years. Go ahead with your work. The same happens with your advisor. The advisor can apply for a grant, gets money, writes a grant proposal, which is judged by other scientists, and you get money. Limited resources. Money is always limited, as you know. There are very few people who say, we have enough. I belong to one of them. Not because I'm rich, but there are two ways of being rich. You know that. Wealthy. One way is to earn a lot. The other way is to need very little. When you need very little, you're also very wealthy, in the sense that you have enough, right? And that's nice. But usually there's you can always do more with more money. This is good piece of research, good time to do it now, do it, right? Money to buy equipment, to travel, to fund your doctoral students who can do the groundwork. If you want to increase your stipends, by the way, one way is to take part in a research grant, research project from your advisor. If the advisor has obtained money, I understand that there is no limit on how much money you can get from that grant. So if the advisor tells you, well, I can pay you $5,000 more every month, that's fine, that's possible. Of course, your advisor needs to have money, needs to get that money, which is not very easy, of course. So if your advisor doesn't have the money, don't think this is a bad advisor. No, it's a lottery. Limited resource, everybody wants that, of course. Funding agencies in US, National Science Foundation, probably the most reputable. It's similar to Fundacja Nauki Polskiej in Poland. Good review process, good reviewers, good scientists. National Institute of Health in Health Sciences. There are military agencies giving you money. DARPA, Navy, Air Force, Army, every branch of the military has money. The review process is less strict. Very often a program director decides. You can get money easier or harder. Depends on whether you are closer to those circles, whether they know you. Networking helps a lot, of course. Foundations, usually smaller amounts of money, but let's say foundations focusing on cancer research. They give money, less. Review process is also probably up to the chairman or chairwoman of the board of the directors of the foundation. Industry can also give you money, industrial grants, usually not very large. Sometimes there are strings attached, sometimes not. So it's also a source of money. Peer review, that's the third mechanism. So publications, funding, and peer review. We talked about it a lot already, a basic mechanism. Your work is judged by other people. It's used in publications, but also in grant proposals. Watch out for conflicts of interest. We may talk about it later. When people review, they have access to privileged information. Information that has never been published. They can possibly assimilate that information, sometimes not by being bad people, but it's very human to think a few months later, oh, that was my idea. Very, very human. So watch out for that it doesn't happen to you in terms of getting idea from papers that you are reviewing and thinking, oh, that's my idea. The process is imperfect, but still it's... Still, good things will eventually get published, sometimes after many rounds of reviewing. When you review, do it well. It's a moral responsibility. Treat others the way you would like to be treated. So if you criticize, indicate a way of doing it better. At least give some hints. Show a superior approach if you don't like something. I mentioned that to you last week, that one of the people I consider my mentors, the big list of mentors, said that people expect from you a few outstanding quality contributions. Sometimes you can publish a handful of papers and still be famous, more known, more famous than somebody who publishes 100 papers of so-so quality. I think it's an important thing that I realized late, well, not too late, but late, and also I confirmed that this is the important thing. People often judge you not by your necessarily only by your work, but also your personality. So try being honest, have good integrity and reliability with your colleagues. Answer emails quickly. When they ask you to do something, do it. You know, the personal character traits are important. Be nice. If you are nice, you will not need to be afraid that somebody will pee in your dishes when you are outside of the lab. Biology lab, of course. When somebody is not nice to waiters in a restaurant or people, I dislike it very highly. But then I jokingly ask them, are you not afraid that they will spit in your soup when they on the way to the table, you know? Basic mechanism. I mean, you should be critical, but you know, be nice to people. That's really a good character traits. Be punctual, reliable. Answer to your emails quickly. That's important. So that's all I wanted to say. Kind of on the margin of that movie, you probably saw in the movie how it is happening, and I tried to summarize the important things. Any questions? If not, then let's start with this topic of identifying problems. It's one of the things that I... let's see, where are we? I learned a lot because, I guess, of the people whom I was around. Whatever I will show you today comes mostly from... one of my advisors, the person that impacted me a lot, really, that was, I'll show him later in the presentation. What is happening? I touched something, I guess. I probably touched something. No? Herbert Simon, so I'll say something about him later, but the things that he talked about were really, I think, quite impressive, and I remember them. Interestingly, I have friends who worked with him also. Oh boy, I'm so sorry for that, but it's flashing, and I don't know why it's flashing. Let me do it once again. Everything from... Let's hope it will not keep doing this. Let's keep our fingers crossed. For the foreigners, interestingly, in Polish, it's...
the thumb, right?
That's right, the thumbs. So how to identify a good research question? I guess most of the time I'll spend on just finding a research question. Dissertation question for you in Poland is already taken care of, actually. You have all research questions, and it's I think it's a little bit of a flaw of the system. I'm still thinking and studying the rules, how to make it better. The reason for that is that, in my experience, somebody who is starting doctoral studies doesn't yet have a very good idea of what the topic of the dissertation is going to be. In my experience, and I have graduated, I think, 9 PhDs, the idea of the exact topic of the dissertation comes like towards the end of the second year, I think. The exact topic of the dissertation, it's a year before graduation. And there is no limit, like here, 4 years. So I think it's a little bit of, it's a challenge for you. But try to make the best of it. With the topic that you have, try to make the best of it. It's possible, but it's not the typical way of finding a topic. So maybe it's of less importance to you finding a dissertation question. I'll spend less time on that. It's a very important thing. It's critical for your success, especially once you graduate, because you are going to be on your own. So far, in the beginning, your senior colleagues were giving you good questions. Your master's thesis, your dissertation, you've been given a topic, so somebody has found it for you. But once you are on your own, alone, you are going to be responsible for finding good questions. And it's very important because it takes just as much time to work on a poor question, poor in the sense of not very interesting, and excellent question. Excellent question, when you say it aloud, everybody in the room will look at you, right? An interesting question. Example of an interesting question? How to cure cancer? Well, you are too young to be worried about it, but that's a good question, right? How to count the lamps in a building? Good question, but boy, I mean, is this very interesting? Not terribly. So, what are the characteristics of an ideal question? It should build on your personal preferences. And I assume you took care of that when you were picking an advisor in the doctoral school. You had some personal preferences, you found a topic, you chose it. But there are other questions that are good to ask. It's like, do you like working individually or in a team? In computer science, sometimes things are done in a team. There's a project team where we are building an operating system and you are going to be responsible for the memory management. Other people are going to be responsible for other things. You have meetings, you talk with each other. They depend on you, you depend on them. But some people don't like that. Some people want to be just alone. And that's a personal preference. What kind of work do you like most? Is it theory? Is it building something? Is it experimenting? So these are personal preferences that you need to take into consideration. It should build on your technical strength. Why? Well, you have only 4 years. If you still have to learn something, that will slow you down. So things that you are good at, the direction, this is a good direction. Because you already have it, you are already ahead. It should also match your plans after obtaining your PhD. So, do you want to stay in academia or do you want to go to industry? And this also impacts the type of questions that you will be choosing for your dissertation. Because if you want to go to industry, taking something very theoretical for which very few people have an application is not going to be very interesting for your future employer. But most important of all, and that's really the most important sentence on this slide, is that when you wake up in the morning, today the sun raises sometime between 5 and 6. So most of you, when you open your eyes, you see the sun shining. When you see the sun shining, you should have the feeling, you could have the feeling, well, let me stay in bed for a little bit more. That's a very tempting feeling to most of us. But when you see the sun outside and the light, you should feel, I need to jump out of my bed immediately, take shower, put on my clothes, and run to the lab, because the work is waiting for me there. Ideal topic should be exciting, something that makes you want to get up quickly and run to work. If you don't feel that, try to build it in yourself. If you cannot build it using different methods, then it looks like you are facing a possible career change, changing a topic at least. I know changing a topic in our school is difficult, but you can do it. I've known cases like that. So the excitement. Why the excitement? Well, because you will do twice as much work as if you were when you were not excited. Twice as much work. It still can be less than somebody else's work, maybe it's more, but it's going to be more than you normally do. So you are going to do more work, you are going to have a higher chance of achieving success. So the excitement. There are many ways of finding a question, a achieving success. There's a saying, all roads lead to Rome. That's a very old saying, I think, probably a Latin saying, Roman saying. The time when Rome was the center of the world, they were building roads, conquering countries around, and every road you found, oh, that's probably a Roman way, right? There is, if you look at, for example, lives of saints, you know what saints are. In every religion, there are people who are, you know, have done something exceptional. They were really exceptional people. You can be, and if you look at their lives, there are many ways of becoming a saint. In fact, if you look at different religions, look at Buddhism, it's called different, right? It's called, I think, Satori, this state of enlightenment. We could call it in Christianity sainthood. In Hinduism, there is samadhi, you know, this again, this state in which you suddenly know everything, right? You are enlightened. There are many ways of achieving that. In fact, every religion shows you a slightly different way. And even within the same religion, you look at the lives of saints, many different ways. The same here. It's a difficult problem, how to achieve success. There are many ways. So what I'm going to show you is something that I heard from one of my advisors, and I like it a lot. And I think there are things there that are useful no matter which way you will pick to achieve success. So it's a hard problem, and the only thing I can do is offer some heuristic. Again, they are not coming from me, although I improved upon them in my own work. I took it from, as I said, Herb Simon. He gave every year a talk for the first year students on the topic of how to find a research question. The talk was, I think, at least an hour long, and I listened to that talk at least 3-4 times, because whenever he gave that talk, I ran to hear it again. So I probably know it by heart, and I put the slides together based on my notes and on my memories. He usually talks about not a problem, but a question. Something that I, not everybody says that, but I think he was always saying a question, research question. In the beginning, it's okay to have a very broad question, like what happens when I do something, when I apply this tool to this problem. It's fine in the beginning. But the important thing is, he said, why don't you, when you have a question, why don't you subject it to four basic tests? And here are the tests. First test is this question solvable within the given amount of time? So, for you, you have 4 years. Well, 3.5 now. But if you are working on in a cycle, you are solving a question, and then you are publishing a paper about this, within the three and a half years that you have, they expect from you probably 2-3 high-quality publications, depending on the advisor. I would say 2-3 would be good, 4 would be excellent. High-quality publication. So now you can say, okay, I'm having my first question. Can I do it within 1 year that I have? Can I write this paper? Can I solve the problem? So it's a good test. If you are, in terms of your dissertation, can I solve it in 4 years? Probably your advisor who has composed the question for your dissertation has given it a thought and believes that 4 years should be enough to answer that question. So in that sense, you are probably reasonably safe with your dissertation question. But individual questions for your publications, the time constraint. Can I do it? So can I finish that paper in a year? Send it out to a journal? Good question. It's sometimes hard to make the judgment, but then that's what the advisor is for. The advisor should discuss it with you and express his or her opinion. Sometimes, of course, the advisor is, of course, always human, may be wrong, so you may want to talk to several people. If you think that you are right and the advisor is wrong, well, talk to somebody else just without any, you know, commitment. What do you think about this? Can I do it? Is it doable? The second test is, will anybody care about the answer? And that's the utility of your work. every scientific piece of work should have some utility. Without it, I don't think it's an interesting piece of research. So, will somebody care? Today we can ask, we can pose it in another way, maybe. Will my paper, once I put it on the website, will two people download it to read it? Right? If so, then probably the question which you put somehow in the title, maybe in the abstract, is probably interesting. Will at least two people download it? Sometimes there are questions that have no apparent utility. For example, DNA structure, structure of the universe, just pure knowledge. There are questions like this, but there are many questions that are just, you know, asked, and the answers are not terribly interesting. There is this link on the bottom. I think it's called Journal of Improbable Research or Improbable Results. It's meant to be a joke, and if you look at that, you will see actually published papers that are not terribly interesting. For example, I don't know, like sounds generated by whales during intercourse. Okay, sounds funny, but is there any utility in it, right? You will find more of this type of questions in that journal. So will anybody care? Simon used to give the following example. Here is a good question that I can solve not only in 4 years, not even 1 year. I can solve it in 2 minutes. How many bulbs are there in this room? I can solve it within very brief time. Is this of interest to anybody? Well, maybe somebody, but probably none of you will be very interested in that, right? Too trivial, too uninteresting. Third test, will I be the first to answer this question? And if you remember, science is a competition, a race to catch a buckyball. Who is going to be the first? The second person who invented something will not be published, probably, because the reviewers will say, oh, we already know it. Jones published it in 2022, right? You are not the first. Sometimes you are competing with other people. It's a race. Of course, the question includes the past, but you can reasonably insure yourself against the past by studying the literature. You can go to the library or do a search on Google and see what have people done so far. Are there other people working on it? That's a very important thing also. If you haven't found anything in the literature, the question, how many people are working on it? The more people are working on this question, the less chance you have to be the first. I will come back to that question because it's a very important question. Another one, of course, is this the right time to work on this problem? Does the present state of science make the research feasible? I mentioned the question, curing cancer. Of course, we have a lot of things, but perhaps we are not quite yet ready. If you look at the at science, even in the movie of the race to catch the buckyballs, you saw it, that the moment there were initial pieces of work done, you notice how many people suddenly joined the race. They joined the race because the tools were ready. They knew how to obtain the crystals of the carbon 60, for example, so they could obtain it and they could perform experiments with it. Before that, it was not possible, right? So time was right. I remember I once watched a series of lectures on calculus, the history of calculus. There were initial pieces of work done in ancient Greece, the Zeno paradox, you know, I forgot what it was, a turtle or a hare, getting closer and closer to the goal, but every second doing half of the distance, half and half and half. The question is, will the hare ever reach the end? That was done in the ancient Greece, and that was the piece that was very important for calculus. But the actual work in calculus happened in the 19th century. One after the other, important contributions to calculus. 19 or 18? Anyway, around there. And Newton, that was 18th century, I think, not 19. So the time was ripe. The same with all kinds of simulations. They could not happen without computers. Once there were computers, explosion of different pieces of work that had to do with computers. Cameras, vision, right? Only in the last, 30 years, and it's getting better and better because the cameras are getting better, faster, etc. So is it the right time? An important question. Can I do it now, or is it too early? Am I too early? Fourth, very important question. I will spend more time on this. Do I have good tools to address this question? So that's a very important question, as you will see, important test. Do I have good tools? An auxiliary question. What makes me think I will be successful? The first answer is very arrogant. I'm smarter than others, therefore I will be successful. That's a very arrogant answer. I think every one of you here is fairly smart. I wouldn't even dare to say who is smarter, because you are all above a certain minimum that it takes, and you're all smart. So saying I'm smarter, well, that's very arrogant and probably not true, statistically speaking. None of you should answer it this way, because there are many smart people are around us. In fact, here's a joke that I heard from a late, forgot his name, Boyle, but I will mention him again in this course. You say that you are in 99th IQ percentile. You know what it is, right? You take an IQ test, it's a bell-shaped curve. Why? Because of the central limit theorem, it's a normal distribution, and you are in the 99 percentile means that you are among 1% smartest people who have ever taken the test. Wow, that's very, very smart. Well, that's an old number. With the population of the world being at that time 5.5 billion, there are only 55 million people smarter than you. Right? That's smart, right? Big competition. Many of them are scientists also, so not a very good answer. Not a very good answer. Randy Pausch, sorry, I forgot his name. I don't think I will ever forget his face, what he was saying, but I forgot his name for a moment. That's my fault. I happen to know him. We will talk about him at some point. Another answer people give is because I work hard. And that's a much better answer. I work hard, therefore I will succeed. But that's not a very good answer either, because everybody who wants to succeed works hard. Look at people who are successful. Look at, let's say, sports people. Justyna Kowalczyk, the skier. I once heard an interview with her on the radio, she was describing her day. You know, she gets up at whatever, 6 or 7 a.m., spends 4 hours skiing, then takes a break, and then again skiing, and then working with her trainer in order to succeed. You work hard. In any field, if you want to succeed, you work hard, because you want to be better than others. There's really very little ways around it. You have to work hard. There was research on expertise in psychology. There is a small branch of cognitive psychology focusing on psychology of expertise. What does it take to be an expert in something? Three very fundamental findings. Every person who wants to succeed is a workaholic, works hard. How hard? Well, 80 hours a week, roughly, or more. Second thing is it takes 10 years of that hard work to become really very good at what you're doing. quite robust among chess players, sports people, mathematicians, musicians, all across the fields. And the third thing was they counted how many things you have in your brain in terms of knowledge. They counted roughly 10,000 chunks. Chunks are pieces of knowledge. I'm not going to get into the details of that, but it's from cognitive psychology. It's just a piece of knowledge. So this is very common. You can say, well, Mozart was composing at the age of 6. Sure. But his masterpieces came when he was 16. You know, he was working very hard all that time to produce those real masterpieces. So you have to work hard. There is really very little way around it. If you are smarter, really smart, maybe it's not 80 hours a week, but 70. Okay, 75, 70. But you still have to work hard. This is the best answer. The concept of secret weapon was came from Simon. I'm going to succeed because I have a secret weapon. That sounds like war, right? We observe the war in Ukraine now. Putin has all kinds of secret weapons, apparently. That's why he thinks he will succeed. So it's a funny term, but you can talk about secret weapons when you are a researcher also. So what exactly is a secret weapon? It is a comparative, possibly unfair, advantage that you have over others. I mentioned to you that the world is not very fair, right? If I'm 176 centimeters tall, if I wanted to become a basketball player, sorry, I would have to be really very lucky, work really hard to become a basketball player. It's unfair that I was born and I grew so little, right? If I wanted to become a jockey and be a sportsman on a horse, sorry, I'm too big for that, right? Because the smaller you are, the better. You have certain advantages. The world is unfair in that sense, right? There are certain things that are not, we don't have. If I wanted to become a theoretical physicist and I wanted to confirm my findings experimentally, working in Białystok is unfair because there's no accelerator. I cannot test it, right? But if I were in Switzerland, in CERN, well, I have an advantage over all of you in Białystok, right? Because I have access to the accelerator. Most Nobel Prizes in theoretical physics are from there. Is it fair? No, that's unfair. But that's the way the world works. So each one of you, in order to succeed, should think about the secret weapons that you have. Because there's no doubt that you have secret weapons. But you just have to look around what you have. Or go to a place where there are secret weapons that in the direction of your research. One secret weapon is a good problem that nobody has thought about before. Personal experiences, things that other people are unlikely to have stumbled upon, that's a problem that nobody has thought about before. Like, look, Kroto. He wanted to study architecture. He knew Buckminster Fuller's work. He had those constructions, those balls in his eyes. And that brought him to the idea that C60 may be something like that. That's a very unusual source of ideas. Advice from Simon was, don't look for research ideas in journal papers. A very poor place to look for ideas. Why? Well, first of all, the authors of the papers have thought about that for several years. They worked on it maybe for a year, wrote it up, and published. If you want to get the idea from the paper, there is no certainty, but there is a good chance that the authors of the paper already thought about this and thought maybe they even tried it. Didn't work. So whatever you notice in that paper as future work, when they write future work, they will probably not reveal their most promising paths, right? Even if they do, even if they reveal the most promising path, they probably already have spent a year on that. Why? Because when they wrote up the paper, they sent it to reviews. The reviewers took several months, and then after the reviews were in, the paper was good, it took several months to publish that paper. The period is shortening now, of course, quick reviews, electronic publications, but it's still months. So they already have advantage over you. They thought about this. Maybe you are smarter, maybe you work harder, but odds are against you. Another thing is, if you read that paper, how many people in the world read that paper? A few hundred probably, a few thousand saw the title, a few hundred read the abstract, maybe the introduction, maybe 50 read the paper, and maybe 5 or 10 of them thought, wow, that's a good idea, let me work on it. So you are already, by definition, competing with them. Poor idea to look for ideas in journal articles. Some examples of looking for research ideas. There is Fleming, it is a good example. His strength was his dirtiness. He was very dirty. He never, as a matter of principle, washed the dishes. He just left them in the sink. One day he went on a vacation that was, I think, about a month long. He came back to the lab, and of course, when he looked in the sink, he noticed all kinds of things growing from there, like, the things that, whatever, can grow in those dishes. But he was a curious person. He said, well, that's interesting. I can see all kind of fungi, mushroom-like substances, in these dishes, but I don't see them there. Why is that? That's an interesting question. I would expect them to be in both places. So he started observing those living things under a microscope, and He started observing, and he noticed that there were bacteria in many places, but there were no bacteria around fungi. That's interesting. Why is that? Maybe fungi have some kind of defense mechanism against bacteria. And that was the beginning of finding penicillin, which was the first antibiotic. And then the rest is history, of course. Nobel knighthood, so it's Sir Alexander Fleming, and discovery was called one of the most influential discoveries in the history of science. Look at that, penicillin cures gonorrhea in 4 hours. Wow. That's the impact, right? Many people would care about this. It was a nice idea, but may not work for you. Since Fleming already beat you to it with penicillin, I take it we can dispose of your week-old sandwich. Being dirty may work somewhere else, but in discovering penicillin may not. Another idea, Benjamin Franklin he did many things. He was one of the U.S. presidents, but he also... He was kind of scientist, definitely a thinker. And around the time that he lived, there was a big discussion in science, in physics, about the nature of the thunder, the lightning bolts that are going from heaven from the sky to the earth. What is that exactly? Is this Zeus throwing spears, or is it perhaps electricity? And people discussed that. They disagreed about it. And he proposed an experiment that luckily he didn't conduct, maybe nobody conducted it, flying a kite during a thunderstorm. Kite on a wire or maybe a rope that is wet, conducting electricity. If you send a kite in the sky, if it's electricity, it will go through the wire. That would be a very dangerous experiment, so I hope nobody conducted it. How did he get the idea? As a child, he was flying kites with his father. So it was something that prompted him to think about it this way. We will come back to these ideas when we talk about creativity. At some point we'll talk about creativity. Past experience is a good source of creativity. Simon himself, when he was an undergraduate student, he did an internship in Milwaukee in a local government office. He was interested in how in economics, you know, sociology, social behavior. And he was definitely an independent thinker, so he had some economics in his college. And then he noticed something that surprised him. Here in this office, there are serious people doing serious work, and they don't behave economically at all. Right? So they are not following economics, which tells you that people are optimizing. People are maximizing their utility, or firms are maximizing their profits. That's a fundamental assumption in economics, if you had any economics so far. So he noticed that people are not doing that. Wow, that's surprising. Like Fleming noticed fungi, bacteria, and that surprised him. Surprise is a very good heuristic. It's surprising. That means that it's different than I thought. If I thought that way, then probably many people thought that way. Maybe everybody thinks that way, and that's a surprising finding. It's flying in the face of what the science knows so far. So that kind of flew in the face of economics, that is very surprising finding. In his work, he proposed, in his work of organizational behavior, that people do not optimize, but they satisfies. He invented that word, satisfies. He meant that they pick the first choice that looks reasonable. When you think about this, how those of you who are married or who have a relationship, is how did you pick your significant other? If I were to optimize, I were 25, I wanted to find a wife, the rational thing to do would be, at that time there were, let's say, 5 billion people, 2.5 billion women. Out of the 2.5 billion, some of them were much older than I, some of them were children. Let's say there was 300 million women who were still unmarried, close to my age. If I were to act economically, I would have to look at each one of them, get to know her. Is she smart? Does she have a good heart? Is she pretty? And, you know, all kinds of criteria that I would use in picking a spouse. If I were following economics and maximizing my function, they call it utility in economics, I would be still looking, and probably I would be still by, I don't know, 500th woman and not 300 million, right? If you think back at, about how you found your significant other, then boy, I bet you did not go through the 300 million or whatever. You pick the first choice that looks reasonable, where your heart starts pounding, right? That's the one. Has nothing to do with the economic theory. So he proposed that, and once he saw a computer, he thought, wow, that's an interesting idea. Definitely an explanation of why people don't do that. They don't have the mental capacity to do all that computation. They don't have enough time. The computers, the memory is not big enough to actually do that. So they face cognitive limitations, and that's how they satisfy. They started modeling people using computers. He was one of the two important schools of artificial intelligence. One was at MIT, and that was Marvin Minsky and others. The other one was, and there was actually maybe third, was the connectionist model, what today is known as deep networks, deep neural networks. This work was based on rules, and that was the work of Simon and his student, Alan Newell. Simon and Newell, a couple that did a lot of good work in artificial intelligence. Nobel Prize is probably the biggest achievement, most prestigious. The biggest in artificial intelligence, Turing Award, he got it. Von Neumann Theory Prize, that's another computer science award. In psychology, he is also very well known, National Medal of Science. In organizational behavior, he is also well known. Everybody working in organizational behavior knows him. So very successful, and look at the source, just almost an accident, kind of open mind, open eyes, being able to see things that many people just see and don't think much about this. Here is a guy I met when I was a high school student in Lublin. I grew up in Lublin, and I was always very curious. So I went to the local university, Marie Skłodowska University, and there was a physicist working in the area of acoustics who was stuttering as a child. Stuttering, jąkać się, to stutter. And he discovered when visiting his grandparents in a village, they had a well like this. When he talked to the well, he got echo, and that echo made him not stutter. When he was talking to the well, somehow he relaxed and did not stutter. He invented a therapy that he called echotherapy. When I was listening to him, that was 1970s, he was very successful, many publications. He opened up a new area in many Polish cities and also abroad, some cities abroad, had a phone number. You could call a phone number, local, and the phone gave you an echo back with a slight delay, your own voice. Of course, today they could put it in a small hearing device, but at that time there were no Walkman, there were no devices like this. So he actually convinced the local phone company to provide something like this. You could call and get echo back, and that apparently helped with stuttering. Very successful as a scientist. Unfortunately, he died. I looked him up later in 2011. But you see an idea again, an idea, an experience that people didn't have, other people didn't have. So the questions that you can ask yourself is there anything that you have around you, like powerful theoretical tools? Newton, the invented calculus, he was quite sneaky about this. He did not publish calculus in mathematics, but he was applying it to many problems in physics. He was solving one problem after another because he had a powerful theoretical tool. He was forced to reveal it somehow because Leibniz started publishing things that came too close to calculus, and then he published it. Sometimes there are big, powerful machines like accelerators. I mentioned that earlier. Sometimes there are tools. In my lab, we implemented Bayesian networks locally and had a richer and richer library that students were developing, contributing to it. It took a little bit of time to learn the library to students. It took a little bit of extra time to do some programming of their contributions into the library. But they had immediately a big advantage over students elsewhere who had to start from zero. Very often they would write a library like this, but that meant a year of programming. And my students didn't have that, so nice advantage. I mentioned Newton and calculus, also very, very successful, and he had a secret weapon that he didn't publish, really secret weapon. Apparently that thing about him being hit by an apple and then thinking about the gravitation, that's not true. He said something very nice. It's a quote from Newton that I will come back to it when we talk about writing and reviewing. He wrote, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants." He meant by that he really gave credit to all the people before him, mathematicians, physicists, and it's something that we should remember, because when we do any type of research, there have been people before us whose research we are using, and we should be very generous in acknowledging them, like he did. It's a very nice statement that he made. Secret weapon can be a training in a discipline that other people are not trained in. Experiences. We talked with you, Robert. Robert worked in forestry. I don't know how long it was. It was a year or two, I think, yes?
Several years.
Working in forestry. You understand forestry much better than a beginning PhD student in computer science. That's a secret weapon, absolutely. It gives you an advantage immediately. So picking a topic to work, you can ask yourself, is there something that I can do? A colleague of mine unfortunately deceased. Last year you heard about an accident at an airport, small airport close to Warsaw. A plane hit a hangar and several people were killed. He was one of them. His wife was also jumping. He was a parachute jumper. She was studying psychology. Her PhD was on the feelings of people doing parachute jumping. Things like fear and stuff. Excellent choice of topic because she had many subjects. When jumping herself, she had many colleagues who could do questionnaires for her, etc. Other examples, I just thought about something. Oh, music. At CMU there was a guy, Roger Dannenberg, he's still there, of course. He was a musician. His work was artificial intelligence in music. How much time would it take a PhD student in computer science to learn music? He could skip all that, and he had a good understanding of music already, right? So things like that give you immediately a big advantage, combining things that you know, like different, maybe you studied something different from what you are studying now, try to combine that. Architecture, maybe you had experiences in your family, let's say a grandfather who had Alzheimer, you read a lot about this because you wanted to help your grandfather, you know a lot about this, so good topic to use in, I don't know, psychology, psychiatry, computer science. It's a good idea to ask a few questions, not just one, and pick, work on the top three. That's an advice that you will see in another lecture of that I will recommend you. I'll give you the access to the recording, Kenneth Olden. That's an American saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket for the reason that you see here, right? If the basket falls, you break all the eggs. So you have to diversify a little bit for safety, for your safety. But don't diversify too much. Just work on the three top three, not more. This is not coming from Simon. Maybe he was also saying that. The idea that you observed in this is a kind of rounding it up. I don't think I will finish everything, but these are loose pieces of advice in the context of finding research topic. Mark Twain said, "The man who cannot read, who does not read, has no advantage over a man who cannot read." Right? If you have a skill, use it. Do something with it. And one of the skills that is very important is being kind of very observant. We have eyes to be observant. If you don't use your eyes, then you have no advantage over somebody who has no eyes, right? Use it and always ask critical questions. Why is that? Be very curious. Learn as much as you can and as diverse knowledge as you can. Don't, that you will hear that in the context of creativity. Our capacity of our brain is practically infinite. So you can really fit a lot of things. I did many stupid things in my life, of course, but one of the most stupid things that I was saying, when I was in high school, I would say, well, chemistry, I'm not interested in chemistry because I'm not going to study chemistry later. So chemistry, you know, or the literature, right, or whatever. And that was a stupid idea because later on, actually, I stumbled across chemistry in the context of computer science, artificial intelligence, and it was actually useful knowledge. The same with writing, with literature. So any knowledge that you come across, just assimilate them. Capacity of your brain is infinite, practically. So you can easily fit all kinds of knowledge, and that knowledge can become useful in being creative in finding topics. That's actually not applicable to your situation now, I think, but maybe just a few things. Listen to your advisor. I would not say it to my students, because that's a little bit immodest. Listen to me. But because I'm not your advisor, I do tell you that as an advice, listen to your advisor. I'm not saying listen blindly, like, you know, really follow the advisor. What the advisor says is a binding thing. No, but definitely consider it very seriously. In my experience, whenever I was not listening to my advisors, I usually wasted a lot of time and then typically ended up telling, okay, they were right. So your advisor can save you a lot of time. Again, don't listen blindly, but consider it very seriously, because your advisor is a few years ahead of you in terms of experience. That is the reason. You already have your topic, so choosing a topic is not a question here. Remember one thing, that your doctoral dissertation is merely a progress report. Sometimes people think that they should really complete it completely, and they, if you have this attitude, you will never say, I'm ready. So you have to accept the fact that you've done work, you've done good work, useful work, you answered a few questions, important questions in the area of your dissertation, but you haven't done everything. And every dissertation will have a chapter, future work. This is where you say, okay, I've done this and this, but there are still directions that I have not finished. So you need to essentially be kind of modest, saying, well, I haven't done everything. There are exceptions to that. If you've seen the movie A Beautiful Mind about John Nash, he was walking around for 1 or 2 years in his university and trying to find the perfect topic. That was very risky what he was doing, but he succeeded. He found the perfect topic and he provided a solution to that, theoretical solution, that today is known as Nash equilibrium. That was his dissertation, rounded completely. Maybe there was something, future work, like other equilibria, but he finished it, he was very rounded, very few loose ends in there. That happens also, but it's a risky thing. So you should at some point say that's been enough. And that point is not that it's 3.5 years and you need to finish. Sitting and doing nothing will not get you there. But doing good work, solving, answering questions, publishing, and at some point, you have explored the most interesting, most promising directions. Discuss with your advisor, is this already good enough to be defended? It's a progress report. Like every paper is a progress report. You should play with knowledge that you are gaining actively. How does it fit in the things that I know? Is there anything surprising? Is there anything that I don't believe in? And why am I not believing it? Maybe you have a potential discovery. You don't believe it, maybe you are right. Real problems are usually a good idea, real problems, rather than imaginary theoretical problems. You should listen, but be careful who you are listening to. All kinds of things, people say stupid things also. So always be critical about that. When you look around, you see how many stupid things people are saying. If you don't know where to look, look at politicians. They have so many theories about the world, and when two politicians are saying two different things, at most, one of them can be right. At most, right? Logically. Think, because this is what we are doing best as people. We don't have claws, we don't have teeth, sharp teeth, but we still are governing the earth. That's because of the brain. That's what we are doing most, and you should use it as much as you can. And test market your ideas. So when you have an idea, talk to your significant other, to your colleague, to your advisor. even if they disagree, even if they shoot down your idea, it's a useful exercise. Creativity, we are going to talk about this. I still have 1 minute, so at some point we are going to talk about it. You have to work hard, definitely. You have to be enthusiastic. Remember, the important thing about the topic, you should try to make yourself enthusiastic. And there's definitely, it's possible. Talk more with your advisor about the impact, about the importance of the work. Sometimes the advisor will not tell you because he or she will assume that it's obvious. I mean, you know it. But talk and try to understand it. Interact with other people, important. But also learn to listen, not just talking, but listen. But critically listen. I think I have to finish. I don't think I will be going through that, but these are some advices that I, pieces of advice that I collected over time. Usually, if there is something that you don't understand, if you find surprising, just bring it as a question next time. I'm not going to come back to these slides. Next week, career planning. I will send you a link to a lecture. It's harder to understand than this one because the quality of the recording is not that good, and the guy is not speaking terribly clearly. But he's saying a lot of wise things. So definitely watch it, and I will try to summarize the important things. So whatever you didn't catch, I'll summarize in the class. Thank you very much. The time is up for me.